You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Koutou katoa, ko Kaden Tokawingua, no mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producers Jasmine and Sanat. E whai akene coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party. News and Editorial Director Joel spoke with Willow Jean Prime about Labour's capital gains tax policy and the defunding of Te Karere and the Hui. For International Desk, I spoke to Professor Armin Seikel, Middle East analyst at Australian National University, on Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti and the responsibility of Israel for the leadership vacuum in Gaza and the West Bank. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
Today, I spoke to Dr. Helen Murray, Senior Research Fellow and Head of Brain Injury and Neurodegeneration Research at Waipapa Taumātoro, on the recommendation to delay our tamariki starting contact sports until their early teens to reduce the risk of degenerative brain disease later in life.
And Sanat, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about people who are struggling to pay their rates bills and regulations around fireworks in the city. I also spoke to AUT's Professor of Māori Philosophy of Education, Georgina Stewart, on the new changes to New Zealand science curriculum.
He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai. Text in your thoughts on 5395 or Waia Mai Rane. Give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wariwari e ahiana koutou te whakarongo ki e ne kōrero anō. E pakehere rokiroki mārongi i te pai, tukutuku o irarangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Recently, the Labour Party has announced a capital gains tax, or CGT, that the party says will help fund 3 free GP visits for all New Zealanders yearly. This announcement follows a leak of the policy to RNZ. Labour's CGT policy has received criticisms from parties on both sides of the political axis. Finance Minister Nicola Willis has called the policy a terrible idea, insinuating the policy will offload costs onto businesses. However, Green Party co-leader Chloe Swarbrick says the policy doesn't go far enough, calling for an extensive wealth tax and higher corporate levies instead. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, News and Editorial Director Joel spoke with MP Willow Jean Prime about the party's CGT policy. They also discussed the funding cuts to the Māori news shows Te Karere and The Hui. But first, they discussed Labour's capital gains policy.
Can you talk us through the party's capital gains tax, particularly what will be included?
Yeah, so we were really excited to announce this week our targeted capital gains tax, which is a tax on property business and personal property, but it's not on the family home. So it's on property that is other than the family home. And it's a targeted capital gains tax so that we can ring fence all of that funding that we get from that to put into our health policies, which includes the new Medicard, which gives every New Zealander three free doctor's visits every year.
We'll talk about the Medicard in just a second, but why will Labor be campaigning on a capital gains tax as opposed to a wealth tax, for example?
Yeah, so Labor has had quite a robust process, a lot of discussion and debate about what we want to do on tax, and this is where we landed. So a targeted capital gains tax on commercial property and residential property, but excluding the family home. And from this, we have said that we will ring fence that to pay for our health policies. So like we have had quite a bit of time to develop this policy, and this is where our party has landed.
How supportive do you think the public will be about the idea of this iteration of a capital gains tax?
I think that the public have been thinking about a capital gains tax for quite a while now. It's something that has been discussed and debated for many years. We are actually now behind many of the countries who, you know, we compare ourselves to by not having a capital gains tax. So I think the time is right for a capital gains tax, a targeted one on, you know, shifting the investment from property into the productive economy and using the money that we will make from this policy to fund the much needed care that we need in our health system. So using that, ring fencing that funding to for the health system to use for three free GP visits for every New Zealander, I think New Zealanders can see that that is a good idea.
Touching on that a little bit more, can you explain more in depth what the Medicard program will be that this capital gains tax will fund?
Yeah, so our health spokesperson, Dr. Aisha Verrill, has spoken to this particular policy. So we have the Medicard, which will have on it the three free doctor's visits for every New Zealander per year. And what we know is that if our people access that healthcare earlier on, they will get the healthcare that they need early, but also that it will take the pressure off our hospitals where we, you know, have a real concern. And so this Medicard will hold those three free GP visits for every New Zealander.
And why GPs specifically? Why not other health initiatives like dentist visits, for example? Why is this capital gains tax funding specifically GP visits?
So that's, again, something that the party has worked on and really thought about where we could make a difference in the challenges that we have within our health system. Dr. Aisha Verrill has worked with our policy council, but also a wider involvement of the sector. And this is one of the really key things that we can do. And so that's why we have come up with the Medicard. We have come up with the three free GP visits per year for every New Zealander and paying for that with this targeted capital gains tax that we have.
Now, we've also seen some funding cuts for Māori media. How concerned are you about the funding cuts to Te Karere and the Hui?
You're really concerned about the funding cuts for Te Karere and the Hui because, you know, it's sad to see programs like Te Karere, which has been around for more than 40 years, and The Hui, which is one of the most watched current affairs shows, lose their funding. They play a really important role in covering important issues for Māori, but also in keeping te reo Māori alive. So it's sad, and I think that our democracy is really reliant on a healthy fourth estate, and I can't see the government's plan. And you know, they've actually been missing in action in terms of support for that media landscape, and here we have the casualty of that being Te Karere and The Hui.
Is focusing on regional news the right direction for funding allocations?
Well, I think when you think about Te Karere and The Hui, you know, Te Karere has been around for over 40 years. It's played a really important role in covering news, current affairs, covering important issues for Māori right across the country, down into the regions, right across the country on a local, regional and national level. And then with The Hui, you know, it is one of our most watched current affairs Māori shows in New Zealand. And so for them to be losing funding for the important role that they've played in Te Kariri's case for decades, it's really sad to see. The government needs, you know, to show us the plan for the whole media landscape, and we're just not seeing that.
Therefore, does Labor commit to supporting funding for Māori media, including Te Reo Māori News?
Yeah, so I'm really proud of the work that our spokesperson and former minister, Willie Jackson, did in this space, and our record shows the level of support and commitment that we have given to media across the board, and including Māori media. And we introduced legislation, for example, like the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill, and it's a shame that this government has put that on hold. So we will announce our policies throughout the process. We're still in development of those policies. And when we are into the election, we will announce those policies. But I think what is important for people to do is to have a look at what our track record was in this space. And I'm really proud of the work that Willie Jackson did.
That was Labor's Willow Jean Prime on the party's capital gains tax policy and the funding cuts to Te Karere and the Hui.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson today about the fact that Auckland Council's Head of Rates, Valuations and Data Management, Rowan Health, has said that 6.6% of rates, or 42,902 households, were outstanding at the start of the 2025-2026 financial year. As cost of living pressures continue to grow in households with rising food, electricity and rents, I wanted to chat to Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson about how Auckland Council plays a role in making life more affordable for everyday Aucklanders. We also had a discussion about the role of fireworks in our community, with major festivals like Diwali prompting some communities to express concern about the disruption that fireworks are causing to their families, animals, and the natural environment.
So Shane, thanks so much for being here with me today. I was wondering whether we could start off with talking about rates and the fact that a lot of people across the country, particularly in Auckland, are struggling to pay their rates bills, even though, you know, the average rates increase in our city is lower than a lot of the rest of the country. What do you have to say about how affordable Auckland Council makes it to live in the city, particularly when it comes to folks' rates bills?
In terms of how affordable Auckland Council makes it, I mean, we try our very best to produce safe money projects and to produce the services that people sort of need and request, especially in a cost of living crisis. You need things like the libraries and the parks and sort of free or low-cost entertainment, and especially for families and stuff like that as well. So every year we consult the public and we say this is a level of service that we're thinking of doing, and this is how we pay for it, and the public have their say on that, and they say they want it higher or lower, and that's kind of where the rate strike actually comes from. But as it relates to people that are struggling to pay their rates, my first bit of advice is to contact the council, which is 301-0101 in Auckland, and just let them know what's going on, because see what options you have in terms of paying it back in different ways and things like that, you know, installments and stuff like that. But have a chat to staff about it if you're struggling is my number one. And number two, just while I'm on the subject, of course, is... you know, there is a rebate scheme. So if you're earning very low income, and in my opinion, it's too low and we've got to increase it. But yeah, if you're very, very low income, then there are ways to get some of your rates back through a rebate. So just have a chat to staff as well on whether that applies to you. That's my sort of ultimate advice.
Sure. I suppose some of the macroeconomic trends that are causing financial strain on a lot of people is stuff around electricity prices, interest rates going up, and that feeding into people's rents as well. And when you add rates bills onto that, sort of people who, you know, working class, every day paying rent, are going to see that in their reflected in their bills as well. I suppose the question is, can council sustainably keep increasing rates that it needs to in order to fund the services that it has, particularly if Auckland's population increases? Or do we need something new that works for the future of the city that's a little bit more financially sustainable?
Yeah, well, you know, this is me talking personally. I've always favoured looking into different ways to fund local government services. And so the rates situation essentially operates as a kind of wealth tax, right? And that works by and large for the but if you say you're on a pension, if you're on a fixed income, then that will eat away at your income over time, right? And then that's a real challenge. And so what ways can we make it more reflective of people's income as opposed to house prices? I definitely think we should explore that in the coming years. But like I said before, rates are actually set by the community, not just by the council. So we say, look, you know, like I said before, that balance between the services that you request versus how you pay for them, that's a conversation we have every year as a community. And it's entirely open to communities to say, look, we want less services and pay less rates, just as you can say the opposite, right? And that's kind of how it all lands every year. And it's an interesting one comparing it to things like insurance, mortgages, power prices, things like that. They're all going up, and it's a big challenge for people. You know, mortgages are sort of flatlining a little bit at the moment, but, you know, there have been challenges in the recent years. But, yeah, you're right. Rates do get reflected in people's rental incomes and things like that. So it's a challenge, and it's up to us to be as productive as we can with the rates dollar and as efficient as we can as well.
Now, the last term of council, there's a lot of talk about Auckland's financial position, reducing debt or putting us in a position to service pre-existing debt. There have been calls from some quarters to evaluate what sustainable debt levels mean for government and particularly local government. Do you think Auckland is in a position to be able to borrow more to service some of the services that we're talking about here? Are we financially set up well, or are there some gaps in that system?
Yeah, look, I think the good news for Auckland residents is that we are set up well, at least in my opinion. We use debt to fund capital expenditure as opposed to ongoing operating costs. Things like when you need to build new pipes and new roads, community centres, things like that, that gets funded through debt. And the argument goes is that we need to spread the cost of that infrastructure over the generations that will use it, right, as opposed to people paying up front. If you were to pay up front and do things a different way, your rates bills would absolutely skyrocket, and that would be a huge challenge for people to actually physically pay it. So there's kind of a practical approach as well, kind of a theoretical reason as to why we do that. But yeah, in terms of what council's position is in debt, that's actually evaluated by Moody's and Standard & Poor's, and we consistently get very good credit ratings, often second only to the government. So that's good news as well. You know, how would you kind of do things differently? Well, we've always got to be looking, like I said, at debt levels, but we're well within comfortable means at the moment. Just remembering the last bit of your question there, I wouldn't be in favour of actually using debt to fund ongoing operating expenditure. That's kind of like borrowing your mortgage in household terms to pay for your bread and milk. That will have ongoing effects down the chain to future generations that will hit our kids with much more unsustainable debt levels to fund, you know, expenditure now. That's not responsible. So that's not something I would advocate myself.
Sure. So moving on to our next topic here, on a slightly lighter note.
what's lighter than council debt levels?
Yeah, what's lighter than council debt levels? Absolutely. Fireworks. It is fireworks season. The Wileys just happened. Guy Fawkes is coming up. A lot of, you know, as we have increased immigration in the city and multiculturalism, a lot of festivals involve fireworks and celebrations with them. That's a great part of the vibrancy of the city. But then at the same time, there are a lot of communities and a lot of residents who talk about how the fireworks are disruptive. There are also environmental considerations with fireworks, concerns about animal well-being and our natural life. So what is the current regulatory framework approach by Auckland Council when it comes to fireworks? Do we have any bylaws or bans or restrictions? And would you be in favor of, you know, putting in some sort of regulatory framework to restrict the use of fireworks around this time?
Yeah, so obviously you're restricted in terms of when you can buy them, right? There's a very, very narrow window on that. That kind of operates as one of the chief controls in fireworks, really. You know, there is a noise control element to this too, if people are really taking the mickey about it. But yeah, you're right. There's every year there's community conversations which can actually get quite heated, pro and anti fireworks for private sales. And yeah, I definitely, as someone that's a father, said to young kids and has a dog, I have my own concerns around that myself personally. But yeah, our council has always been advocates for greater restrictions in terms of private sales. But yeah, that's still an ongoing discussion every year. We revisit it, and every year it sort of stays the same, which is a bit of a challenge for us. Yeah.
Have you been getting stuff from your community about the use of fireworks? Is this an increasing concern?
100%. I mean, one of the, in addition to the issues that I've already pointed out from my community, so I represent the Waitakere Ranges area, and there is always concern around things like fire risk when you're talking about fireworks, especially in wooded areas as well. So yeah, I would just advise people in the first instance to be really considerate of their neighbours and their community. And if you like the status quo as it is, then maybe act with overabundance of caution, you know, because community backlashes will gather momentum and steam, I would imagine, in the coming years. And so, yeah, make sure that if you do want to partake, then you do that responsibly. That's my first advice, yeah.
I guess that goes to a broader question about how, you know, how Aucklanders navigate the tension of communities coming here, bringing in their own cultural practices, and then, you know, disestablishing or, you know, waking people up at night with all their damn fireworks and stuff.
Yeah.
How do you see the future of the city going in that direction in terms of that, you know, cohesiveness bit, that social cohesiveness bit, where, you know, we can have that multiculturalism, we can have people practicing their festivals and celebrating with each other, and neighbors that aren't necessarily as grumpy about it in the future?
Yeah, totally. That's a really good point around sort of social cohesion and different cultural practices. We're seeing with Dwellium getting a lot more in terms of fireworks going off recently around our neighbourhood, that's for sure. We've basically all got to try and get along as a community, and I don't think anyone wants to kind of denigrate cultural practices. We want to celebrate them. That's what makes our city such a great place to live. How I see the future with that, so, like I said, it's a complicated picture, but looking at regulations that are sensible in some form to kind of restrict things and manage things at a community level, maybe that's the answer. And even looking at working closer with local boards so that there's local flavour to that discussion too. I'd be in favour of that. But yeah, like I said, it's all a little bit up in the air at the moment. Yeah.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on rates, arrears and the future of firework usage in the city.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have this show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4 with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
You ready to play?
Yeah. I've just got to piss real quick. All right. Showtime. 95BFM Drive Live. Trillions of listeners will hear me. I'll finally make Mum proud if she listens. Maybe Freddie will listen and finally think I'm hot and cool and lovable. Oh, come on!
Hurry up!
Okay, this is it. Time to shine. Crap. No toilet paper.
Tune in every Friday live. Music beaming in direct from 95BFM Drive.
Friday Live on 95BFM. Thanks to McLeod's Brewery and NZ On Air.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Our go.
The future of Palestinian leadership remains unclear as the current Palestinian Authority leader Mahmoud Abbas remains unpopular and heavily criticised. One candidate for leadership is Marwan Barghouti, who has been described as a Nelson Mandela-like leader for Palestine. However, he has been imprisoned in Israel since 2004, facing ill-treatment and torture. Many activists and leaders, including groups like the Elders, have called for his release. I spoke to Professor Armin Seichel, Middle East analyst at Australian National University, about Marwan Barghouti and the broader leadership crisis in Palestine. I started by asking if he could explain what the Palestinian Authority is and who is currently in charge.
Well, the Palestinian Authority was created under the Oslo Accords, which was signed in 1993 between the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was headed by Yasser Arafat at the time, and Israeli government. And that was done under the auspices of the United States. The Palestinian Authority was created and it was banked, and it was supposed to be in charge of the governance of the West Bank as well as Gaza. But of course, there was another movement which had emerged, particularly during the second Israeli Palestinian Intifada, which is the uprisings from 2001 to 2005. And of course, that was and gained strength during that intifada, and that was the Hamas Islamic movement, which was very much anchored in Gaza Strip. And subsequently, of course, there was a split between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has publicly admitted, he basically fueled this split between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Simply, he did not really want the Palestinian nationalist movement to be a united movement, and he could at the same time claim that the Palestinians did not have a united political leadership with which it could really negotiate a political settlement. But at the same time, it was very clear from the very beginning that Prime Minister Netanyahu had been opposed to the Oslo peace accords as well as the Oslo peace process, and therefore he did everything possible to basically destroy that process.
Could you speak a bit to why you think Marwan Barghouti is the best person to lead in the Gaza Strip, and where is he currently?
Well, Marwan Barghouti basically represented the younger generation of the Palestinians. He was a member of the Palestinian Legislative Council in the 1990s, and he also led the street protests, particularly during the Second Intifada, which was from 2004 and 2005. And he was extremely popular with all the factions of the Palestinians, and not only in the West Bank, but also in Gaza. And therefore, he provided to be the only individual who could actually unify all these factions and also put in a great deal of energy into the Palestinian nationalist movement. At the same time, he enjoyed, or at least he succeeded in cultivating good relationship with many elements in the Israeli peace movement, as well as some Israeli government officials. He is fluent in Hebrew, and also he's been able to really communicate with the Israelis very effectively. And he has basically adhered to the principle of peaceful settlement of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And the only reason that he supports participated in the Intifada, or the Palestinian uprising, because that he wanted a peaceful resolution, in other words, or a peaceful resistance to the Israeli occupation. And as a result, he was detained by the Israeli authorities, and he was charged for murdering Palestinians, which he had denied. And also the trial that took place was a very, very dubious trial and was highly, really suspected. It was very much motivated by political considerations of the Israeli authorities, and he was imprisoned for life in 2002. And he's been languishing in Israeli jails ever since, and he's been transferred from one jail to another every 6 months. And a video has emerged lately in which it shows that the Israeli national security minister basically taunting him in the jail. He looked extremely weak and frail. He's now about 66 years old, and also the latest report is that at one point lately he had been beaten by the Israeli authorities in the jail, and had gone unconscious. Although he has come out of that unconscious state, nonetheless, he's in a very weak position. We don't know a lot about his living conditions in the Israeli jails at the moment.
I've seen some discussion that a lot of potential Palestinian leadership are currently imprisoned in Israel. Is that a fair assessment? And if so, why is this the case?
I think to me it appears that Israel really does not want to release those Palestinian leaders who are really capable of moving a peaceful settlement forward. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist ministers, particularly the Minister for National Security and Minister of Finance, they are very much really determined, or at least they have really alluded to the concept of Greater Israel. They are very much determined to expand Israel territorially. And if the opportunity arises, they very much would like to really annex the Gaza Strip, and also formally annex the West Bank. In fact, the annexation of the West Bank has been going on for a long time. Israel has been carving the West Bank bit by bit, you know, over the years. What Israel so far has not done is to formally declare the annexation of the West Bank. But as you know, the Palestinians would like the creation of an independent state of their own out of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as East Jerusalem as the capital of the future independent state.
If people like Marwan Barghouti are imprisoned and there is no clear leadership in Gaza, or for that matter, even the West Bank, what does this mean for the near future of Palestine?
Well, I think the concept of the two-state solution, which has been backed by the international community, at the moment seems to be in a very fragile state. That concept is unlikely to be achieved in the near future, simply because that Israel has been creating a lot of facts on the ground, particularly in the West Bank, as well as, of course, in Gaza. I mean, still Israel occupies something like about more than 50% of Gaza. And the ceasefire, which has been put in place there, is extremely fragile, and the Israeli authorities have been treating it sort of a la carte. You know, they continue their military operations whenever they feel desirable. That is simply because that while President Trump has declared the war over, but Israel has not really fully accepted President Trump's 20-point peace plan. It is under American pressure. Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to the implementation of the first phase of the plan, which is the ceasefire. But that has been the easiest part of it. And of course, also a ceasefire, which Israel has been breached many times. That's not to say that it's not also been breached from time to time from the Hamas side, but Hamas has really denied violating the ceasefire and some of the actions which have taken place against the Israelis have been in Rafah, in Gaza, and Rafah has been under the control of the Israeli authorities. And some of the gangster groups that Israel has armed against Hamas in that region of Gaza. And it's not very clear that, for example, in the last week or so, three Israeli soldiers have been killed. Israel has accused Hamas, but of course, Hamas is not the only group. There are other groups which have been which are active, and some of them, of course, have been armed by the Israelis to operate against Hamas.
That was Professor Amin Saikal, Middle East analyst at Australian National University, on Palestinian leader Marwan Barghouti and the responsibility of Israel for the leadership vacuum in Gaza and the West Bank.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk.
Our go.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
International research to understand the relationship between degenerative brain diseases and head knocks that occur in contact sports continues to develop, with New Zealand researchers calling for a delay in children's involvement in contact sports until they are older. Risk factors are not exclusive to concussions or to professional players. I spoke to Dr. Helen Murray, Senior Research Fellow and Head of Brain Injury and Neurodegeneration Research at Waipapa Taumātoro about this topic. Kia ora, Helen. Would you be able to elaborate on the breadth of contact sports that are risky?
Yeah, so when we're looking at repeated head impacts and that exposure to these sort of, you know, repeated head knocks, the sports that we play in New Zealand that we come to mind the most are things like rugby, football or soccer, however you want to call it, and then other sports as well that might not be as well known. I play ice hockey, and that definitely falls into the category of repeated head knocks. But then, you know, as we talk to more and more people, we realise that there's lots of other sports that could also be involved there as well. You know, I've talked to netballers that have had quite a few concussions and head knocks, and field hockey players. So, you know, I don't think it's necessarily limited to any one sport. There's probably a range of sports, but we want to be a little bit careful around how many head knocks we get.
What changes occur between the ages of 8 or 9, where we do see a lot of tamariki in New Zealand pick up contact sports, to the ages of 13 or 14 that's being advised to be a bit of a risk reduction for any future complications?
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question. So it's not necessarily something about, you know, brain development that we're targeting here. The research is really showing that it's the number of years of cumulative exposure to these head impacts over a long, long period of time that is the biggest risk factor for long-term brain disease. So what that means is that people who play collision sports for a very long time and experience lots and lots of head knocks, hundreds of thousands of these over their lifetime, have a higher risk. And so what we're saying is that one of the easiest things that we can do to make our sports a bit safer in the long term is to reduce the number of years of contact exposure. And so if you have a kid that starts playing, say, age 5, and another kid who starts playing age 15, contact, you know, the one who started at age 5 has had 10 years more exposure if they keep going. So by starting at age 15, we're essentially trying to reduce the number of years of head contact, head collision.
In addition to reducing the cumulative number of years of head contact and collision, how else do statistics gathered about the increased risks of degenerative brain diseases translate from world-class professional athletes that might be at the centre of some of these studies to the abilities and gameplay of local communities?
Yeah, this is another really good question. You know, the majority of studies that we do looking, you know, across populations that quite often do come from professional level, because we've got a lot of data around how many minutes they've played, their head injury assessments and that kind of thing. But it does really translate to our grassroots and our amateur and our social players as well, because essentially what we're learning is, again, it's about that cumulative exposure. So there's not like a a specific number of concussions or a number of years of play that is, you know, specifically dangerous for everyone. It's about that exposure over a long period of time. And, you know, we study brains of former athletes once they passed away at the Human Brain Bank at the medical school. And you know, we see in people who have been professional athletes and also in amateur athletes that these brain diseases can occur in these groups. So it's not restricted to professional athletes. We do want to encourage anyone playing collision sports and especially things like you know, boxing, martial arts, where there can be a lot of head contact. You know, we want to reduce that as much as possible to reduce that risk.
In May earlier this year, Palmerston North teen Ryan Satterthwaite tragically passed away from participating in the Run It Straight Challenge. What are your thoughts on approaching unregulated trends that can cause head-on combat and harm in this way?
Yeah, you know, I recognise that everyone is going to have a different appetite for risk. You know, some people will look at this information and go, yep, you know, I want to do it anyway. But what I would really encourage people to think about is just that long-term view of, you know, a brain disease is really a horrific thing to go through for both yourself and your family. It really strips away everything you are as a person. And so by protecting your brain health, you're really making sure that you live, you know, the best life that you can for a long time. And so I just think, you know, a moment of caution to think about some of these things that are really high risk, and things like the Run It Straight were particularly dangerous because there was an intent to collide. It was at pace. The speed involved, and there's this element of, you know, having to show off to a judge, which can, you know, increase that damage again. So we just really want to highlight, you know, your brain is so precious. It is who you are, essentially, is because of your brain. And so, you know, please look after it. It's a delicate organ that isn't very good at regenerating itself. So we need to do everything we can to look after it.
And how do you best perceive a path to that cultural shift required to change habits around sporting passions and uptake for our tamariki starting at that young age?
I think it's already starting to happen. You know, a lot of our sports are really taking this seriously now. There's been a lot of great initiatives from New Zealand Rugby in terms of, you know, making sure that people pay attention to head injuries at the professional game, and getting into the grassroots more as well. I think as a society, we're a bit more aware of what a concussion is and what head knocks are, and, you know, why we should be limiting that. So I think, you know, we're moving in the right direction. But it is really about admitting, you know, to yourself. I think as an athlete, I know it, sometimes it's really hard to go, actually, I'm not sure if I'm okay. And it's a courageous thing to do, to actually step back and give yourself a moment to recover. I think it's really important that we keep up that message that we look after each other, especially in our team sports when we're playing alongside each other and you might notice someone isn't quite doing so well. These are all the things that, you know, we want to do to protect ourselves in the game, but also, you know, for future years as well.
And what's next for your mahi and research in this area?
Yeah, our main goal with our research, you know, from talking to athletes, families of people who have been affected by these brain diseases, is diagnosis. The number one thing that people are struggling with is hard to know sometimes if the symptoms people are experiencing, especially when they're quite young, are related to a degenerative brain disease or potentially something else. And so we want to give people some idea of, you know, what they're dealing with. And that is also really important for developing clinical trials and therapeutics, because if you don't know who to treat, you can't really you know, develop these sorts of things to help people. So our number one goal is to develop MRI scans, blood tests, some kind of, you know, battery of tests and tools that will help us give people a sense of, you know, hey, actually your brain isn't doing so well just now. Maybe you need to rest and recover. Or, you know, you could be developing something that's potentially going to be long lasting here. So just giving people more information around what their brain health is doing.
That was Dr. Helen Murray, Senior Research Fellow and Head of Brain Injury and Neurodegeneration Research at Waipapa Tau Mātauru, on the recommendation to delay our tamariki starting contact sports until their early teens to reduce the risk of degenerative brain diseases later in life.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
The government has finally released its long-coveted curriculum rewrite for subjects ranging from science to drama. The new curriculum has faced growing criticism from sections of the education sector, with some calling the new curricula old-fashioned and criticizing it for sidelining Te Tiriti o Waitangi and Māori knowledge. I spoke to Professor of Māori Education Philosophy Georgina Stewart about her views on the changes specifically to New Zealand's science curriculum and whether those changes are fit for purpose.
I just wanted to start off
with asking about the new changes. Actually, let's take it a step back further. There have been multiple curriculum rewrites over the last couple of years, both from started by the Labor government and this new national-led government as well. I was wondering whether you could give some context to our listeners about why it is we need to rewrite curriculums in Aotearoa.
Curriculum is always in relation to its context. So curriculum theory is really that part of educational theory that that pays attention to changing context and the need to update curriculum. The last time that the curriculum was updated in Aotearoa, New Zealand was in the mid-2000s, and I put it like that because it's not something that happens all at once. And that's the case with what's been happening in the last few years. So although in a way you're correct to say that there's been a number of rewrites, there have been processes started but not completed that began under the last Labor-led government, and then when the National-led government came in 2023, the direction that those developments were going in was subject to considerable change. So it's actually not until, when was it, the day before yesterday, that I was able to see the new science curriculum. It's something we've been waiting for at least a year. We've known it's coming. And there's been a lot of uncertainty and some debates in the sector. We know of people who've been invited to be part of the writing group and then uninvited. So it's the case that there's been a lot of anticipation of this curriculum. But the one that we are now looking at, the one that was released on Tuesday evening or afternoon, is the first new science curriculum that's been released to the public since the mid-2000s.
I want to ask about two things, but I'll split up the question. The first one is around the process of curriculum rewrite. So you talked to me a little bit about people who've been invited and then uninvited. Yes, there we go. So we've talked about how curriculum rewrites are, a process, and those are processes that have been initiated over multiple instances, and that it's culminated in this new science curriculum that's come out. I was wondering if you could give me some insight into whether you think this process by which we redesign and rewrite curricula for new contexts are fit for purpose, whether we do it well. One, and then two, what is the sort of changing context these new curricula are trying to respond to?
Well, for about the last 30 years or so in this country, there's been a process of, we could call it writing curriculum by committee. So fairly large groups representing the different stakeholders, primary, secondary, principals, all sorts of kind of science leaders. I am really thinking about the science curriculum here. So the curriculum has different parts, and the processes that have been started in the last few years have really started with the big picture stuff. So that's why it sort of seems like it's been going for a while. So that kind of curriculum writing by committee is designed, to have buy-in really from a wide range of stakeholders in the education sector. That I guess it's fair to say that first of all, no curriculum is perfect, and a school curriculum is it's always a political hot potato because what it's education, what's taught in schools, is one of the few levers that the government can press really to make changes, social changes. I think the pluses and minuses, well, that committee sort of approach, the large writing group, the representation of a wide range of stakeholders, obviously it enables buy-in, encourages buy-in. People feel included, people feel it's, they've contributed to it, so they are inclined to back it. So that's not really happened now in this latest round. It's been a much more top-down driven process. But I guess the minuses are that when you have such a wide, you know, range of people involved in writing a curriculum, you end up with something that really nobody's happy with, number one, you know, because you're sort of trying to find a common ground between people with widely varying interests and ideas. But the other thing is that curriculum does have a sort of an expertise, you know, associated with it, which is what I referred to before as curriculum theory. So it is quite astounding. I've read quite a lot of curriculum theory in the course of my studies and research. And there's just things that people are trying to do that just don't make sense. I believe myself personally that we in this country, we've made the mistake of expecting the curriculum to try and do too much and solve things like social problems, things like economic inequity, that a curriculum simply can't do. So those are sort of some of my thoughts about the process. And then in terms of changes, well, you know, we see changes coming from, say, there are new things that come in, like financial literacy and coding. Those are things that people have kind of said should be in the curriculum recently that weren't in the past. As the sort of whole world of work and employment changes, those things will impact. Yeah, and then I guess things like the current sort of, we're facing a future that's increasingly uncertain in terms of the environment. So that would pertain particularly to science, but across the whole curriculum as well.
So I'd love to now get into the science curriculum itself. Can you maybe give me a little overview on what those changes look like for our listeners? And then also just walk me through a couple of your thoughts about these changes, whether you think they're effective. You know, you mentioned the fact that you don't want you personally don't think curriculum should be doing too much. Do you think it's scoped appropriately, that it's going to be able to respond to those changes in context that we're talking about? Or is there still more work to do in this public consultation phase?
It looks to me like it's fairly ready to go. I don't think there's necessarily going to be a lot of change as a result of the consultation period. And I would like to just focus my comments on the science curriculum, in particular years 0 to 10, because that's what's been released in the last couple of days. And I'm somewhat embarrassed because it turns out that there's a lot of negative reaction coming through. I mean, just looking on, you know, at the media reports, principles and things like that. So I don't want my comments to be seen as a great big tick for the whole thing. I think that it is concerning that there's been a lack of transparency and so on and so forth. But if we just look at science curriculum for years 0 to 10, so that's mostly our primary schools, right? And in primary schools, teachers do not have science degrees generally. And science is often one part of the curriculum that is not taught much. We can talk about things like the narrowing of the curriculum that was encouraged by numeracy and literacy standards in the previous National League government, but for a whole host of reasons, research and talking with teachers will tell you that science is often very much comes at the end of the line in the primary classroom. So I'm coming from that point of view that the simpler, the clearer the curriculum, the more likely it seems to me that teachers will teach it with it. I like the fact that in this new version, it gets straight to the parts that the teachers really want to know about, you know, the content, what's to be taught, the teaching and learning content. I like the fact that each section starts with a brief list of the typical kinds of equipment and materials that would be required at that level. Those are sort of practical ways in which I think this curriculum is kind of closer to the classroom teacher's needs. The number of strands has been reduced, and we've gone from 5 levels covering year 0 to 10 to 4 phases. Those are significant changes because they sort of simplify the overall structure, but it's not like they're hard to get your head around, if you see what I mean. So I think that those are to the good. But the main change, I think, for me, is that the nature of science has been completely dropped, whereas in the previous curriculum it was an overarching strand. But it was never taught well. People don't know what it is. I mean, unless you're going to do a doctorate or at least a master's degree and really read into, you know, the nature of science for me. Okay, let me unpack this a bit more, because what do we mean by the nature of science? But, you know, the question of what is science is a very complicated question. And there is a thing called the philosophy of science. I never even heard that term until after the end, after I'd finished doing a Master of Science back in a long time ago. We don't need to go about that, but my point, I guess, there is that although there is this big branch of philosophy devoted to the philosophy of science, you don't hear about it if you're studying science. So nature of science has tended to be, by kind of shoving it into the primary science curriculum, I believe that was a sort of an interference rather than a good thing. So for me, the fact that it's been dropped because it was never taught well, because it couldn't be, how could it be taught well, is a win.
You've pointed out something around this nature of science part that I'd like to talk a little bit about as well. Maybe quickly, does this new curriculum continue some of the stuff that was brought in the last rewrite around Mātauranga Māori and Indigenous scientific knowledge?
Well, yeah, that's another whole big complication that has been a source of very active debate and discussion in the sector. And I'm pleased to see that it does retain enough Māori content to make it clearly a curriculum from here, from Aotearoa New Zealand.
Now, the last question I sort of wanted to ask is around the global competitiveness of the curriculum that we're trying to implement here. I think a common complaint or observation, particularly from young people who are engaged in STEM, education, has been around the fact that comparatively, when they look at their peers who have studied the Cambridge curriculum or the IB curriculum, or who've come from overseas, they are much more globally advantaged. They can translate the skills and the knowledge they have gained in those curricula into admissions into universities, more competitive research programs, better paying jobs in STEM fields. Now, do you think that the curriculum that we're sort of designing here is allowing us to have that same sort of rigor and global competitiveness in STEM fields?
Well, we're sort of conflating a lot there. Cambridge and IB are not so much curricula as qualifications. And so they are usually held up against
the science curricula in Cambridge and IB are specifically designed for those qualifications, though, right? So are the ones that we're doing for the New Zealand Qualifications Authority, do they stack up against those?
They're usually done instead of NCEA, which is our homegrown qualification. It's quite hard to really get into all of that right now, that's why I did preface my remarks, but I'm just really talking about the year 0 to 10 science curriculum. But here's the thing, everyone wants more kids to learn more science. Everyone wants New Zealand to grow our own Kiwi scientists. But you don't get to be a scientist unless you, you know, do a PhD for a start, right? And you don't get to do a PhD in science unless you can go to university and do a BSc. And you don't get to do that unless you've qualified in science at school. So, you know, it all drives back down. But if we're not even teaching science at all in primary science classrooms, then, you know, that's we're nowhere. So I'm looking at the need to kind of have much more science being taught in the primary, you know, this year 0 to 10. Kids up to, you know, going up to sort of, this is the year 10, as you know, I'm sure, is sort of around 13, 14-year-olds. So we've got to have science being taught better there to encourage more kids, because the numbers tell us that once a student has the option to drop science, which happens in year 11 usually, most students do drop it.
That was Professor Georgina Stewart on her views on the changes to New Zealand's science curriculum.
That was The Wire.
Era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa e kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Willow Jean Prime, Australia National University's Armin Saikal, University of Auckland's Dr. Helen Murray, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, and AUT Professor Georgina Smith. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.